Hi, I'm Dr. Caroline Leaf, and welcome to my podcast, Cleaning Up the Mental Mess, a podcast where each week I share practical and simple tips and techniques to help you take back control of your mental health and life. At one point or another, we've all done something to undermine our best interests. Even the most successful people get in their own way, often even without realizing it. So, in this episode, I sit down with Dr. Judy Ho to discuss the 6 steps to stop self-sabotage, why humans are predisposed to self-sabotage, how to identify the triggers to self-sabotage that are unique to you, and how to deal with grief and loss, and how to remove the limits we place on our minds that may be holding us back from our healing. Dr. Judy Ho is a triple board-certified clinical and forensic neuropsychologist and co-host of CBS's The Doctors. Her book, Stop Self-Sabotage, 6 Steps to Unlock Your True Motivation, Harness Your Willpower, and Get Out of Your Own Way, is amazing and filled with great simple to-do tools and exercises for long-lasting change. Thank you for tuning in once again to my podcast and for all your support. If you liked today's episode, be sure to leave a review on iTunes and share this episode and podcast with friends and family and on social media. Welcome, Dr. Judy, to the show. I'm so thrilled to have you here. I love your new book. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You've just released it, haven't you?
Yes, it was. It was just a few months ago.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, it's so interesting, and I've listened to you a couple of podcasts, and I'm really thrilled because I believe you bring something really important to the whole world of mental health. So I'm very excited to dive in and share your wonderful knowledge with all my listeners. So
thank you for coming. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really, really excited to be here.
Oh, no, it's fantastic. It's so exciting. Okay, so the first thing I want to ask you is, what got you interested in, I know you're a neuropsychologist. That's also my background as well. What got you into neuropsychology and specifically studying or doing research in the field of sabotaging, how we sabotage our thought life?
Well, I love neuropsychology because it really focuses on how our brain and how the patterns in our brain really affect our behavior.
I love
getting deeper into that concept because people used to think that there was this mind-body dualism, right? That there is this idea of the body being separate of the mind. And now we know that it's completely linked. And so whatever the mind is reacting to, the body will react as well. And I always really was very, very interested in that relationship. And when we talk about self-sabotaging behaviors, that's exactly what we're talking about. It's like you say to yourself that you want to reach a goal, that you want to do something, and somehow, why aren't your behaviors following through with that? How come you're making missteps? And I think it really does go back to our neurobiology. It goes back to something that is very evolutionarily based and something that is really essential to humans that kind of gets turned on its head. So something that was actually very good and survivalist, when taken in the extremes, ends up being a problem. And that's really what I think self-sabotage's roots are.
Very, very good. That's excellent. Yeah, I do a lot of work in mind-body research showing how you can't, they're separate, but they integrated, how your mind will move through your brain responds. And I think it's so important that people recognize the importance of our mind. I almost feel we live in a society where we kind of exclude the mind and we don't bring in the body enough. So you make a couple of comments like, you know, people don't realize the impact of our thought life. And I thought, yeah, there's another believer in my court. It's one of the things I'm always saying as well, is our thought life is vitally important. So I'm really excited you talk about that. Judy, from your clinical experience and research, how do people get stuck? And let's start there. How do people get stuck? Can you give us some examples and how-tos and how it happens?
Well, it's really interesting because I think sometimes when people are worrying or when they're ruminating, like thinking about one concept over and over again, they believe in some way that they're actually trying to solve a problem. But it's actually not the best way to approach the problem. And yet it kind of feels like you're being active. And so then people end up doing it. They end up having all of these self-sabotaging thoughts, or they have the same thoughts over and over again. They keep reviewing their mistakes over and over, but it doesn't then translate into action.
Okay, now that's really good what you've just said. You've taken the concept of rumination, where people think they're doing something because they are, but they're not doing something constructive.
Right.
They're kind of going around, you know, the tread keep going around and around that little hamster wheel as opposed to moving forward.
Exactly. And I think that that is something that sometimes people don't realize. You know, sometimes they think about rumination as something that's completely negative. And well, I think there's a part of rumination that is your body and your mind trying to do a positive thing. It's trying to solve a problem, but it's not getting anywhere, because the minute one thought appears, then you're chasing after that thought. Then another thought appears and you chase after that one again. And there's no place to kind of step back and say, how do I stop this cycle and actually start to do something productive in my real life?
So what is one of the first steps to start doing that? How do you do that?
Well, I think a lot of times people ignore their thought life. Like you were saying, it's so important to be attentive to your thought life. I think that sometimes thought life is scary for people. You know, it can be very ambiguous. You have no idea like what kind of thoughts can come up if you're meditating or if you're doing anything like really paying attention to what you're thinking. And I think that is kind of what trips people up, because they almost block out some of their thoughts or they avoid thinking about it. They have more of an escapist mentality when very stressful thoughts come up. But thoughts are not scary. They're just mental events. And just because you think something doesn't mean that it's going to come true. Yet we have that idea. Like if you think about something terrible that could happen, all of a sudden your emotions are already caught up to that. Your fantasy life is running away from you. And I want to just remind people that thought life is not scary, but the more awareness you can bring to your thoughts, the more you can see whether or not there's certain patterns that happen over and over again. And once you recognize those patterns, then you can do something about it.
I love that. I love the fact that you've said awareness, because that's one of the most important things as a neuroscientist. We see that, you know, once you become aware of something with your mind, you become aware of what's in your thought life, you bring it into your conscious awareness. That's when you can actually do something. You can't do something about something that you've suppressed and pushed down. But the narrative today for mental health is very much along the lines of, you have a disease, you know, just that's the thing, you've just got to deal with it and kind of suppress it, as opposed to face it, deal with it, immerse yourself in it. And I see you talk quite a lot about that, of dealing with your stuff, not being scared to face your stuff. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, oftentimes, especially in our society now and our culture in this current time, there's so much fear of any kind of suffering that, you know, there's a lot of social media, there's a lot of commercials, and just kind of what we see, it's kind of a propaganda of, it should always be the absence of negative emotion. You should always go
after
Yeah, that you should always be going after positive emotions. And yet, how would you recognize something as a positive emotion if you never had the other side? And the other piece of it is, you don't need the absence of negative emotions to live a well-lived life. And so I think now there's been more and more people talking about this idea of values-based living. And if we're living according to our highest values, things that we say are the most important to us, that we want to abide by, that we want to be remembered by, then the path is not smooth. Like, think about any big goal that anybody's ever had, from moving across country to pursue their dream job or getting married, having children. There's so many upsides, but there's also challenges. And so if you never wanted to have any negative experiences, you would never get anywhere in life.
You wouldn't know what the positive feels like. And would you even appreciate the positive?
No.
You know, and that's, you've got to have the balance of both.
That's right.
Do you think, Judy, I've seen from my experience that people are almost scared to like to deal with the depression, to face that it's okay to be depressed, it's okay to be anxious, it's part of life. It's almost so, as soon as people feel any, you said it yourself earlier on, as soon as people feel any discomfort, they don't know what to do with it, because society's the positive psychology bent and everything's got to be fine all the time. Do you see that fear in people? Are you also seeing that fear in people of being scared of depression, of anxiety, of feelings in general? And as soon as they feel this, any level of discomfort, it's almost as though, oh, it's bad. Well, it's not good. It's telling you something.
Right.
How do you feel about
that? I mean, that's a really great observation that you just made. And I think that you're right. There's more and more people who do become more fearful of that. And I think it comes from a couple of places. One is, maybe they saw that in their parents or in their upbringing, where even their parents are sort of saying, don't talk about your negative feelings. Like, they're giving them some type of life lesson that it's not okay to speak about your negative feelings. But then as they grow up into adults, maybe they've internalized that, but it's being reinforced by the culture. When you look at social media, for example, everybody's posting their best pictures. They're posting their highlight reel. And you think in your mind, because we're social animals, as a comparison, I don't feel that way. My life isn't shiny like that. And then it starts to make you feel bad about yourself. And then you want to run away from that feeling, because you don't want to be less than. You don't want to feel like you're not doing as well as somebody else in your life that you're comparing yourself to. And I think that that really makes people struggle a lot. But I think, as you mentioned, if people just embrace the fact that depression and anxiety can just be part of the normal experience, it's part of life, we have ways to treat it. Oftentimes it's even transient. It's not going to stick around forever. But it's that if we wrestle with that idea more, it actually sticks around longer. Those negative feelings linger more if you keep shoving them away and never dealing with them.
That's so true. That's so good. Now, I know you still practice clinically and you're still seeing patients and you have patients in crises and that kind of thing. What are, if, when you're in a patient is in a crisis, what are some of the first things that you do in terms of what are the, some of the first things that you do? And also, how are they getting to those places? How do they get there? How can you help them get out of those places? What are you doing to manage that?
Yeah, you know, I think when my clients show up, usually they're ready for change, but they're afraid of change too. Mm-hmm. And we kind of have to start by acknowledging that. I mean, it's great that they came to the office. Mm. It's great that they're saying they want help. But change is very hard for most human beings because change means that you're letting go of control. And it makes sense from a survivalist perspective that human beings would want as much control as possible because that means that you can predict your environment and that means that you're guaranteeing your own physical and emotional survival. But of course, most things are not what they appear. And most of the times you think you have control and you really don't anyway.
Yeah.
And so we have to sort of deal with that idea first, you know, this idea of change. I mean, we talk about this, there's a saying, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know, right? Yeah. And I think that's why people get into these sort of patterns, whether it's a bad habit or whether it's something that's even more sinister, like maybe they're struggling with drug and alcohol abuse. And yet somehow those negative outcomes that they keep veering themselves towards is still easier to conceptualize than a future where things could be more positive and they could have better relationships because they wouldn't know how to deal with that because they've never dealt with it before. So I think the first place to start is acknowledge the fact that change is scary, but also recognize that you've already done this pattern before and you're obviously not satisfied.
It's not working.
So let's try something new because what do you have to lose? You can go back into that old cycle anytime because you've already done it so many times.
Yeah, if you practice at it. So you can do it really well. Okay, so the first step you say is to acknowledge that you need to change.
Yes.
Before we continue with today's podcast, I want to take a moment to tell you about a product I am so excited about and cannot recommend enough, Four Sigmatic. Four Sigmatic makes healthy and organic coffees, elixirs, blends, and so much more that are not only delicious, but also very nutritious and great for brain health. Right now, I'm drinking my favorite product, the coffee mix with lion's mane and chaga, which really helps keep me focused and boosts my mental clarity. And for all of you listening today, you can get 15% off your entire order with the code DRLEAF, spelled DRLEAF, F as in Freddy, at checkout or go to foursigmatic.com/DRLEAF. The link will be in the show notes. So what I'd like to ask you now is if you could very simply define self-sabotage, and then I know in your book you've written about 6 steps to dealing with self-sabotage. Now, obviously, you can't explain in huge detail, but as far as possible in a nice, simple, practical way, can you talk us through the what is self-sabotage in a very simple way? I know you introduced it, and then the 6 steps that you've worked on
in your research. Yeah, so self-sabotage, put simply, is when people get in their own way despite their best intentions. Could be about anything. Could be about their career. Yeah, it could be about their career. It could be about relationships. It could be about trying to change a bad habit. But whatever the case is, you've made a goal to yourself. You've made a commitment to yourself. And somehow, despite your best intentions, you keep having missteps. And why is that? A lot of times people have a lot of shame about that. You know, they think, oh, maybe if my willpower was just stronger, or maybe if I had more motivation, they beat themselves up. But that's not productive because self-sabotage is universally wired. We all have the propensity to do it. And it's because all human beings have just 2 main drives, all of us do, and it's to attain rewards and to avoid threat. And when those things are in balance, then we're thriving psychologically and physically, we're doing well. But when those things are out of balance and you start to prioritize avoiding threat more so than attaining rewards, that's when self-sabotage starts to rear its ugly head. And avoiding threat isn't just about physical threat, because most of us are not battling saber-toothed tigers anymore.
Exactly.
It's about all the psychological threats. It's about, what if I get rejected if I ask this person out? What if I apply for a promotion in this job and somebody laughs at me? You know, it's all of those things that end up holding us back, and we forget about the fact that if we were to achieve that award, it would be so rewarding, and it would just propel us towards even better outcomes in the future.
Fantastic. That's really good. Okay, so you speak about your six steps in your book. Can you talk about this?
Yeah. Well, the first thing that I have people do is look at their underlying drivers for self-sabotage. And I have an acronym, and the acronym life. Is LIFE.
Yes. That was one of the questions I wanted to ask
you. So it's just an easy mnemonic for people to think about the four major factors that tend to lead people to self-sabotage. So L stands for low or shaky self-concept. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't believe that you deserve better, you're not going to do better, right? Mm. And that's really a very simple way to put that particular acronym together. I, internalized beliefs, is things that we learn from childhood, whether that we picked it up from our parents or our upbringing or other important adults. If our parents were very anxious and nervous Nellies, we might become like that too.
Yeah.
F, as we just discussed, is fear of the unknown or fear of change. And that can affect a lot of different individuals. And then finally, E is excessive need for control. So these are people who are very type A, go-getters, perfectionists, but sometimes that actually gets in the way because unless everything is perfect and under your control, you don't move forward. And so for anybody out there, they may find themselves being represented by one of those four letters, or they might say, oh, there's more than one that fits me. But I think it's an important piece of beginning to become aware of your thoughts.
Okay, so you start then with the life concept. And I think you've got all kinds of, you've got a questionnaire and a quiz.
Yeah, I have a quiz, and I have one on my website too, so people can kind of take it in like two, 3 minutes and find out what their life factor is.
Okay, so there's the fact that either one or multiple of those, and that's the first step.
That's like a pre-first step.
Pre-first step, like
so you kind of figure out what that is. And then you kind of move into the rest of the steps, which of course the first one begins with awareness of your thoughts. So really understanding where your patterns are. So now that you know your life factors, how do your thoughts work? Like where are your ruminations? You know, for some people, it's very black and white thinking. You know, they make one mistake and it's like
the end of the world.
Yes, that's it. Or for other people, they do too much social comparisons. It's always about comparing themselves to somebody else and how they never measure up. And then for other people, it could be things like catastrophizing. You know, before you even get there, you're already thinking about all the horrible things that can happen. So once you figure out kind of where your thoughts get stuck, we then talk about ways to address those thoughts.
Okay.
And so the next step is really about intervening on those thoughts. And I think in traditional cognitive behavioral therapy, we talk a lot about thoughts and how we might have to change unhelpful thoughts into more helpful ones. But sometimes you might not be in the mood to do that because
you're going like, to using more of the ACT therapy type model.
Exactly. Go ahead and explain that. I love it. It's a very important
point.
So I talk about these interventions and they're kind of like half CBT and then half ACT. So some of it is just traditional CBT where you use a thought log, you take a look at your thoughts, you try to change them into more helpful ones, you try to make them balance. You know, I use a rule called yes, but. So like, yes, I fell off of my healthy eating today, but I've been doing it really well for the last 2 weeks. You know, so you kind of recognize both sides.
I like that, yeah.
Yeah, but then if that doesn't work, because sometimes, you know, sometimes you wake up and you're just like, I just can't get out of this negative mode today. And even if I write a helpful thought, I'm not going to believe in it. That's when ACT is so important, which is really de-emphasizing the impact that these negative thoughts can have on you. So ACT is really about sort of understanding that all thoughts are just a mental event. And I have one really quick technique where you basically just label the thought as such. So if you have a thought like, I'm never going to reach my goal, then just putting a clause in front of it, like, I'm having the thought that I'm never going to reach my goal. And all of a sudden, it doesn't feel like it's definitely going to happen anymore.
It's because you've just labeled it. It's more just a, and you almost, you know, you've changed its context, haven't you? Instead of it being me in this moment now, you're kind of standing back and acknowledging it, saying you're having that thought, but it's not who you are at the moment.
Exactly.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that that is the key difference between that type of technique versus a changing a thought.
Which can put a lot of pressure on the person because if they can't do it, then think, what's wrong with me?
Right. And then that makes them feel even worse
even
about
worse
themselves.
Worse about themselves. Exactly. Yeah. So by using the more, so the ACT is going more into sort of almost embracing it. I don't feel good in that moment, but that's okay.
You just accept the thought as what it is. But like you said, you change the context of the thought. So the thought itself is the same. It's still there, but you've changed the context by labeling it as a thought, that you're having a thought. It's separate from you, right? Sometimes when we have thoughts, it feels very internal to ourselves. It feels like it is us. It feels like it defines us. And it's really about separating that. Like, I'm having a thought that dot, dot, dot
as
makes the thought something else. It's external to you.
As opposed to I am, or this is who I am. Because I find when I was practicing clinically as well, that when people get stuck in that now moment of they just completely immerse themselves in all those feelings. They just can't get beyond it. That's when they get stuck in the depression and the anxiety, and those are manifesting. Whereas what you're saying is, which just sounds like you're saying the same thing a lot, where if you just embrace and allow yourself to experience that, people aren't giving themselves permission literally to experience that, because the world's messages through social media, as you've said, and just through the general narrative of mental health is human and positive psychology, where there's good and bad in that. But from the bad side, we've got this whole thing, well, what's wrong with you? There's something between, you know, there's something wrong with you that you, why can't you get through this? Or just apply this little quick trick and you should be through that. And there's something wrong with you if you're feeling sad. And that's really bad, because that's not normal.
Right.
It's normal to feel depressed or anxious or whatever, and to have to take time sometimes to process through that.
Yeah, and to have those ups and downs, that it doesn't mean anything bad about your own mental wellness.
No, or your value system.
Yes.
Or your identity.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that I talk to a lot of people about is grief, because I think grief sometimes can be a very complicated emotion. And it can sometimes lead people to self-sabotage, you know, especially in ways where they start to pick up bad habits. So people, sometimes dealing with grief, they'll find that they're drinking more than usual, or they're stuffing their feelings away and eating a lot of junk food. Mm-hmm. And I tell them, you know, you when people are afraid of grief, it makes sense, because it's a very difficult emotion. You never know when it's going to come
up. Exactly.
Sometimes you're angry. Sometimes you're really sad, and you have no idea. You know, you were just fine 5 minutes ago. Yeah. All of a sudden, you got a reminder or something, and you're getting really sad. But I always tell people to embrace grief. It's that idea of that ACT model again, where, you know, the grief just shows you how much you've loved the person that was gone. You know, it really just shows you how beautiful that love was, and how great that relationship was. And so, you know, when I first lost my grandmother, who was like a second mother to me, I was happy when I cried from time to time for her. Yeah. I still am, because it makes me realize how much I still love her. You know, it's almost like I'm honoring her by being sad, right? So it's like changing the narrative of what those negative feelings are, and not even labeling them as negative, but thinking about them as a productive way to express yourself.
Okay, I love that. So if someone now who's listening to this podcast has just lost someone and they're in a state of grief, what can they do now? What is the exact thing they could do right at this moment?
Well, I think a lot of it is about distress tolerance. You know, it's like when you have those negative emotions, how do you ride that wave?
Yes, and that's good.
It's hard for people, because again, you try to push away the negative feeling. You're like, well, if I was stronger, I wouldn't still be sad. It's already been a year. You know, you have all of these different things that you tell yourself. And it's really about imagining emotions like waves in the ocean. Like, they come and they go. And if you ride them, then you're in control of them. But if you're fighting them and you're trying to go against them, you're trying to push them away, you're just going to get towed under, right? And so it's idea of recognizing that emotions are fleeting, and if you just ride the wave, they'll actually pass. The negative emotions will actually pass a lot sooner than if you're fighting them. And then the other thing that I also think is very helpful for distress tolerance is also just to do the opposite of how you feel. Sometimes people forget that actually does help. You know, there's a lot of research that shows that even when you're not in a good mood, if you force yourself to smile or force yourself to half smile, it actually does improve how you feel. Mm-hmm. And so remembering that when you think about that cognitive behavioral model, you know, your thoughts can drive your feelings and then their feelings can drive behaviors, but it can go the opposite way too.
It can. That's not a fixed thing. Yeah. That's almost too simplistic, isn't it? If you think of it, it's much more complex.
That's right. So they're all interrelated.
So when they're riding that wave, how do you help them manage riding that wave?
So
some people can get lost and drown in the wave.
Right. It gets really difficult. And I think that, you know, oftentimes I try to get them to imagine and personify the feeling as an object or a person.
Yes, I read that in your work, and I love that.
Yeah, I think it's helpful only because, well, there's a lot of research now that shows that is helpful, which is really cool. Recently, there was a study that came out of China where they took some inspiration from the movie Inside Out.
Yes, I love it.
Yeah, I did too. And they basically told all of their participants, imagine a negative emotion as a person, a character, like give them features, give them a face, give them a tone of voice, and that those individuals compared to the other group, which were just to imagine emotions as a regular emotion you know, no other descriptors, they ended up feeling those negative emotions less intensely. So the people who imagined them as people actually felt the negative emotions in a less stressful way.
Even, and it seems to be even more powerful than speaking it, because you can speak them out. You can speak them out specifically.
Yes.
Or you could speak them out specifically, and you can actually imagine them as a, as you say, a person or even an object.
Yes, absolutely.
And you find that works with, has that helped your clients in...
Absolutely.
In dealing with grief or in dealing with all kinds of different...
All kinds of things. Yeah, I think a lot of it is about sort of a mindfulness exercise I like to do with my clients. Having them take that negative emotion, imagine taking that negative emotion out of their body and onto the table and examining it and giving it features, you know.
So almost like literally physically doing that, take that out of you and put that. What about grief? Would that work for grief as well? If people are feeling unbearably weighed down, I'll give you an example. Just recently I was doing a conference and one lady came up to me at the book signing and she was wearing a heart monitor, and it was because she had just lost her husband. I think it was honestly a couple of weeks prior to this conference, and it was part of what she does, so she had to be there. And she said she's had to wear the heart monitor because she's literally, you know, the situation where you can literally die from grief, where her heart, she was experiencing tachycardia and all kinds of things. And someone, you know, I was talking to her just about the grief, and I was thinking something like, because I told her as well, imagine that, you know, take that and put that out there and see it, see that person. You know, when I read you that you do that too, I was really excited because she said no one had ever told her that. Everyone had told her, okay, the grief is there, time will heal. You know, the worst thing you can say to people, time will heal, and you'll get over it. You never get over grief, and time never heals. But it's somehow you've got to learn to manage it.
Yes.
So it's the coping strategy in the moment. And that's what she was asking for. What do I do now?
Right now.
Today. Yes. In this moment. I'm sitting here, I'm in this great conference, I'm very excited, but to hear this, but I'm also dying inside. And like, what would you tell someone like that in that particular moment if someone came up to you with that situation?
You know, I think aside from some of the things that we've been talking about, like, okay, there's like the riding the wave, there's like taking it out and giving it descriptors so that you can really feel like it's physical and outside of you, because even the Grand Canyon, which is huge, has physical boundaries. So when something is taken out of your body and it's a physical world thing, it feels more manageable than when it's inside and totally amorphous and you have no idea how long it's going to go on for. But the other piece of this, of course, is the values-based living. Because when people have grief or any kind of negative emotion, oftentimes you hear people say things like, well, when I'm not depressed anymore, then I'll go find a job.
Yes.
When I'm not depressed anymore, then I'll hang out with my family.
It's going to be something else in the meantime. So
And it's all about, you know, this whole ACT philosophy is about, even when you're in the middle of stress and distress and negative feelings, you can still do the things that are important to you. You don't have to wait for that.
I love that. I love that philosophy. It's fantastic.
I love it too, because really then the improvement of your emotion is actually a byproduct of you living a values-based life.
So if you pull yourself away from community when you're feeling depressed, it's not going to make you feel better. And even if you sit there depressed in amongst your family or your friends, at least you'll start feeling better. That's what the research is showing. And and also helping people. That's and I'm sure you've read the research about how you can improve your own healing by a factor of, I think it's up to 68% when you reach out and help others in your worst place.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that sometimes people, again, you know, when you become very, very intensely depressed or anxious or in the middle of grief or any kind of negative emotion, you become self-centered in a way. It's not self-centered in a selfish way, but it's just you're so focused on your own suffering that it's very hard for you to have the bigger context. And yet that feeling of meaningfulness and something bigger than yourself and belonging to something, all of that pulls you out of those negative emotions. And so it's probably the last thing that people want to do when they're not feeling good, but connecting with a community, doing something nice for somebody, all of those things help you lift out of that dark cloud.
What is, like, what is, if someone is in that, they don't even want to get out of bed. I mean, they literally just want to give up. They don't want to live anymore. They just, what is something that you could tell them and also their families? How do you help a family help a loved one? So let's start with, what would you tell that person who's really, really in a bad place? They just, they just don't want to carry on. They don't have the energy. Start with that and then we'll talk about the family, how we can.
Well, I think when people are feeling that bad, they're so easily overwhelmed and they think too far ahead almost.
That's good.
And it's really about taking things one step at a time. Because sometimes they'll say, well, it's overwhelming to even think about getting dressed. And it's like, okay, but let's not think about that just yet. What's the first thing that you have to do? Do you just have to sit up in bed and do that? Okay, now what's the next thing that you have to do? But people take themselves too far down. You know, a lot of times people become overwhelmed because they're thinking, oh, and then I've got like five other things that I have to do and I haven't cleaned my house, and then all of a sudden they just
and all the expectations that other people have of them. That can also
It's very stressful because they don't want to cause pain to the people that they love either. And so I just say, take it one step at a time. And then once you finish that step, then ask yourself what the next step is. But you don't have to plan out your whole day.
And those are tiny steps, like even go to the restroom, clean your teeth, you know, maybe you walk to that next room or something. So it's a small, those tiny little tiny steps. And then to reward yourself in terms of maybe then sit down and relax a little bit more, watch TV or something like that. Is it?
Yeah, exactly. It's like take it one step at a time and just do what's needed in the moment. You know, that's really important too. Sometimes people think, oh, I have a million other projects I haven't finished. That's not the time for that right
now. That's sabotaging, isn't it? Yeah. That's very sabotaging.
Yeah, people think like too globally when they don't need to, when they can really take life moment by moment. And so that's where I tell people who are suffering is like, what's the next step? You don't have to think 5-10 steps down the line,
right? I love that.
And with families, I always try to educate the families that when somebody is feeling bad, it's going to be hard for you to reach out to them because they're going to push you away. And sometimes you hear that, you know, people get depressed and then they become more and more isolated because they keep saying no to visitors. They get cranky when people reach out and then people stop reaching out.
And that's the worst thing.
That's the worst thing. And, you know, it's interesting because there's a lot of research that's come out of international studies that show that countries that are more collectivistic, they have lower relapse rates for schizophrenia, major depression, bipolar disorder. Why? Because you're already living in that community. And people are all around you all the time. And they're like, hey, you're not doing
they're
so well
noticing,
today. We're going to walk you out. You know, we're going to take you around the park. And we don't do that quite as much in America.
No, we don't. Have you seen that study that came out of Berkeley? You probably have read the study where they interviewed the Japanese. They went to Japan, interviewed a lot of people in Japan, and then they interviewed them in America. And the question they also they asked them was, what is the most important thing for you as a person? And in Japan, which is much more collectivistic and community-focused, their answer was to be an important part of community, to contribute to community and to be part of. So it was, all their focus was on that, on the community. In America, it was my passion, my goals, my vision, me, myself, and I. You know, it led to a whole lot of other studies, and that just comes back to our, we're not meant to be individuals. We're not meant to just be focusing on ourselves. And we also need each other to help us through, which is what you, you know, when it comes to the family. When people say, I don't want help, what they're actually saying is, I do want help. Is that not?
Yeah, absolutely. Correct? I mean, community is so huge. And I think also in more westernized countries where there's more individualistic tendencies, this idea of an identified self becomes more and more of a problem. You know, again, if you don't reach a goal, then it's all your fault. You know, then you beat up on yourself. You know, any emotion, any negative thought you have is all about you and all of your deficiencies. Whereas when you live in a community and that's your value, there's so many different ways to feel better when you're having a bad day. Because it's not just about what you accomplished that day as an individual or who you are in terms of a personality trait. It's about what role are you serving your community? Like, are you still a good mom? Are you still a good friend? Are you still a good teacher? All of those things are equally important. And I do think that we can take some things from collectivistic cultures that can really help with our own mental wellness.
Right now, I am recording this podcast on my phone while traveling between conferences in multiple different cities. Luckily, I have one of my favorite snacks to help keep me fueled and focused. Superfat Nut Butters. These nut butters are certified keto and paleo, and the healthy plant fats support sustained levels of energy, cognition, and mental clarity. The main ingredient, macadamia nuts, are scientifically proven to help speed up fat metabolism. Superfat Nut Pouches come in 5 different and delicious flavors and are perfect for kids' lunches, office snacks, trail snacks, and travel snacks. My personal favorite flavor is the Nitro Coffee MCT. Superfat is offering a special discount just for my listeners. Get 15% off your order when you use the code DrLeaf at checkout. Just go to superfat.com and use the code DrLeaf at checkout. That's DrLeaf. This episode is brought to you by Juve, an at-home red light therapy device. Red light therapy is a powerful, non-invasive treatment which delivers natural wavelengths of light to your skin and cells. Numerous studies have shown red light therapy can be an effective modality that we can use to help heal and improve our mental, cognitive, and physical health. It's one of the best things I recommend for optimal health and an integral part of my self-care routine. Head over to juve.com/DrLeaf. That's J. OOVV/DRLEAF. And if you use the code Dr. Leaf at checkout, you'll get a nice bonus gift with your purchase. Judy, this is brilliant. I love what you're saying. Can we come back to your six steps on, I know you've spoken about two. Can you just very briefly recap those two and just walk us through the other four very briefly? Obviously, people can get your book and they can get the detail in your book. If you could do that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first couple of steps, you know, before we even do that, we dive into the life factors. We understand which of those are actually driving our self-sabotage, because everybody's is different. Then the first step is identifying your thought triggers, you know, really understanding what are the thought patterns that you keep getting into that lead you to self-sabotaging behaviors. And the second step is addressing those thought triggers. Yeah, and so one way is those cognitive behavioral therapy techniques where you start to try to develop more helpful thoughts. But the other way is really about dealing with the thoughts in a different context. So the thoughts don't have to change, but it's that ACT idea of labeling the thought as what it is and moving on and not letting it impact your life as much. Mm-hmm. Then we move into the ABCs. And this is, of course, the antecedents, behaviors, and consequences. Really getting people to understand that there's a sequence of things that happen. You get triggered. It could be thoughts, but it could be other things. It could be a memory. It could be a certain environment. It could be about being around a certain person. It could be a certain time of day. For example, snacking. Most people do terrible snacking at night, not in the morning, right? So you find out what your antecedents or triggers are, not just thoughts, but everything else in your environment. And then you find out what the behaviors are that it leads to and the consequences that you're trying to change. And once you understand that behavioral chain, then you can start to apply strategies to use replacement behaviors, which is step four. So when people have these self-sabotaging behaviors, how do you change it? Well, you identify behaviors that you can replace that would be more helpful and lead you to the things that you really want. And then step five is all about really understanding your motivation and how to actually build from your motivation to actually have the willpower that you say you don't have. And this is where we start to get into some of the values work, because people don't realize that, like, sometimes what they're talking about is motivation, it's just because their goals are misaligned with their values. And so it's really about finding out exactly what's motivating you from a values perspective rather than goals. So it really should start with your values first. And then your goals should come second and should feed into your values.
Give me some examples of values.
Yeah. So values would be things that you want to pursue. And they're not things that you can check off. So you can check off a 5K. You can check off running every single day, but you can't check off the value of health, right? Because you're not going to say, oh, I've had enough health, I'm done now.
Yes, right? Exactly. Yeah.
But all of those types of goals feed into the value of health. And you can say that you want to spend more time with your family. Maybe you want to say something like, oh, I want to call my mom every day. But that's a goal. But what is that value that's superseding that goal? Is it that you care about family? Is it that you care about community? Is it because you care about, you know, strong relationships? You know, you want to find whatever values are really nurturing you and things that you really want your life to stand for. And then the goals should come from that. And people sometimes, like, they'll put a goal up because their friend has the same goal, or they look on social media and somebody else is doing some 30-day challenge they want to do it too. Okay. But, like, where is that coming from? Is it really important to you personally?
Because you're not going to continue. There's no sustainability if you don't have that value established.
Exactly.
So people should ask themselves that question very, very deeply before they just dive in.
Yeah. And in my book, I actually have a values card sort, which is also downloadable from my website, where if you're not sure about values-based work, you can actually do this card sort to figure out what are the most important values to do. It's a card sort. So it's basically like a little game that you play. It's almost like a little solitaire game that you play where you sort your values from top to bottom so that you can really understand what your top values are.
Do you find a lot of your clients in your practice battle to sort their values? Is this a general problem in this day and age?
I do, because I think we're so focused on goals that when I start to talk to people about values, they're like, I don't know what my values are really. You know, they're like, we haven't thought about that in a long time. So the values card store is just an easy way. It's a tangible way for them to kind of be able to figure that out, because sometimes it's been years before they've even asked themselves, like, what's truly important to me on the inside?
I love that. You know, that used to be very much the philosophy 60 years ago, but this in this social media age and our extrinsically driven society, it's all about the external reward and getting it in, isn't it?
Yes.
So the values have almost shifted to an extrinsic versus intrinsic. If I'm hearing you correctly, this card sorting game is just a very simple way of actually getting people to look at what is your real intrinsic driver, which then leads to that motivation
aspect,
which is then going to lead to sustainability for the changes that they need to make.
That's absolutely right. You know, motivation comes from within. It doesn't come just from looking at somebody else's goals and seeing how they did it. You know, it's really about you. And really, this is not necessarily a new philosophy because it's thousands of years old, right?
Exactly.
Plato and Aristotle talk about this, but then we like lost our way at some point.
Technologically wise, I think there's been so much good and so much bad. And also, but I think it's also in terms of why this has changed. I think it could be, and I'd love to know your opinion, something to do with maybe how we've become such a reductionistic society, which shifted about 60 years ago. And we became so focused on the physical and the external, we forgot about those spiritual values, which shifted a lot. Even the research became so like evidence-based, which is good to have evidence-based research, but you've got evidence-based research that looks at numbers as opposed to the individual person, which is also research.
I know.
And I've done a lot of my research in the field, in South Africa, in this country, working with people. And I think you've done a lot of similar kind of research directly with people. There isn't one pattern.
No.
Every human's going to react individually.
That's right. So, and you know what? I think there is a shift. It's almost like we overcorrected at some point. Right? Everything became so evidence-based and numbers-driven that we forgot
about the person.
The importance about the person, the qualitative research, the experiential research, all of which is equally valuable.
Exactly.
Because it gives you the context.
Exactly. It was pushed aside for a season, and I see there's a move back towards that. So
where
we can, and essentially, simplistically, when we talk about qualitative research, just for the listeners, we're talking about looking at the individual in their individual context, their story of their life, not trying to say you're just one of, you don't fit the bell curve, which tells you nothing really about what's going on in your life at that particular moment.
Yeah, I always found it so interesting to read about, you know, anthropological research, right? Where it's all experiential. It's all qualitative. And then they write a whole book about, you know, their year living with the Inuits, you know?
Exactly.
I love that kind of research. But I think at some point people thought that that wasn't as important. And I think that's kind of, that's a really good analogy to values and goals. Goals are very numbers driven. It's very,
very
much like, yes, no, did I do this? Check it off. Values are not as easily defined like that. It's the whole picture. And you're never going to be done living a value if it's really important to you. I mean, if you're, one of your values is honesty, are you ever going to be done living that value? Probably not. And if that is truly one of your values, do you think that's going to be an easy life? No, because some people will not want you to be honest with them. You might get into fights and arguments with people. You might have very negative feelings as a result of you ascribing to your honesty.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you can't be afraid of it. And that's why you have to get back into your values so that you can live from an authentic place.
Oh, I love that. I love that. I think honesty, authenticity is what's, I don't think it's intentionally gone missing, but I think it's happened when you remove that whole sort of almost spiritual side of us, that whole qualitative side, which has happened a lot.
People are afraid of constructive criticism, it feels like. You know, as a professor right now at my university, I feel like people, when they hear constructive criticism, they immediately think, oh, this reflects badly on me. They become defensive, as opposed to, wow, this constructive criticism can help me improve. It's a process, right? People are really afraid sometimes of hearing negative things now, which I think is what's driving our society to feel like we have to pander sometimes or always say something nice. But
it's come from a lot of the sort of positive psychology move.
Isn't that weird? Because it was such a good idea at first.
Yes, it was. And it did do so well and it did start shifting, but it's now it's gone the other way where people don't know how to grow, and you can't grow unless you have positive criticism.
I know.
And that's a huge part. Don't you think that also that can also make people feel depressed because you know instinctively you need to grow.
Yeah.
But if you're not going to learn from what people say to you or learn from your experiences, if you're too scared to experience life, you can't grow. And that can add to those feelings of inadequacy and attached and be attached to your values as well, and or distort your values, distort your perceptions.
Absolutely. I mean, that kind of goes back and drives life, right? The low self-esteem that comes from that, the fear of change or the unknown. And I see this problem sometimes in some parents too, where parents are approaching their children like little porcelain dolls and they don't even allow them to stumble because they're afraid of how they might deal with that. But where does resilience come from? Resilience comes from experiencing challenges, making your way through them, and looking back and saying, I did that.
Exactly.
I survived that. So I can survive other things.
Exactly. Yeah. It's almost like we have to get used to ourselves and help our children get used to almost like high levels of stress in a safe environment. So when you go out there in life, if you're used to an 11 level of stress, you can deal with a level 5. But we're not even letting our kids get to a level 1.
Right.
Because of that. So when they get out there, they collapse at the first the first challenge.
And so you're not actually setting them up for life and for success. And, you know, I think a lot of this and the big message in my book is about psychoeducation and setting expectations, you know.
Okay, speak about that. That's very interesting.
Yeah, because you can't affect positive change in yourself or other people if you don't expect to stumble along the way. You know, mm-hmm. people have said this very before, good. That failure is the mother of success. You should just expect that you're going to fail. But why does failure have to be a bad thing? You know, failure gets you to the next step.
Exactly. It's a great thing. It's a learning experience.
Yeah. And I think sometimes people, they're not prepared for that. So then when they make a mistake, they beat themselves up. And then they think that that's going to motivate themselves. But no, the more you beat yourself up and that negative self-talk is just going to feed into your self-concept. It's going to make you feel even less efficacious. And then the next time you have another goal, you're just going to give up before you even start.
Before you've even started. Are you seeing that pattern in any specific age group or is it across the board?
I do think that it's generally across the board, although I see it more in like our younger people right now. Mm. So I would say that, you know, of course, it's not every single younger person, but I do see it being more common in the generation that's growing up right now in grade school, in high school, and then the 20s and 30s, you know, sort of the people who are in their 20s, 30s, and having a lot of this big issue. And I'm sure you've seen this too when you're practicing and in your interviews, the failure to launch syndrome. That wasn't really a thing 10 to 20 years ago. This idea of a 30-year-old man who like can't move out of the house or get a job and hasn't finished college yet. This idea of failure to launch. I don't remember this being a concept 20, 30 years ago.
No, definitely not.
But it's a big problem now.
It is a huge problem. Speak a little bit more about that.
Yeah, you know, I think the failure to launch syndrome is definitely a type of self-sabotage. Mm. And I think, again, it comes from a place of maybe, and this is not every single case, but it comes from a place of having maybe some codependent family members who every time you stumbled, they went and saved you. So you never learned for yourself.
You never got to even level 3 of stress management. Yeah. You were like a 0.
Yes, exactly. And so I think
no skills.
Yeah. And now as a 30-something year old, you see everybody else around you having jobs, moving out of the house, and you're not able to do it. But it's this negative cycle because every time you try to do something and then you encounter a hardship, someone in your family is coming and wrapping you back into their arms and saying, don't worry, I'll take care of you. I'll pay your next month's rent. I'll pay for your groceries. Like, don't worry, you don't need to get a job. Mm-hmm. We can wait another 2 months. So then you never get out of that pattern. And so in some ways, it's almost like the codependency of people who deal with people with substance issues.
I wanted to ask you, that was my next question, a little bit about addiction, and because you've got an interesting take as well around that.
Yeah, because I think addiction in many ways too is a type of self-sabotage that's driven by the life factors. A lot of times people fall into the same patterns of addiction because they're feared of change. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they fall into that pattern because they have a lot of negative thoughts about themselves and they have a very low self-concept. So when you have a low self-concept, you're not going to be good to yourself. You're going to do destructive things to yourself, like utilize alcohol and drugs when you know that it's not good for you.
And to numb it.
Yes, absolutely. And I also find that a lot of people with addiction issues, there was internalized beliefs about the role of alcohol and substances that perhaps they learned from a parent that that's a way to solve or escape problems. And of course, the problems never really go away. You actually end up having more problems as a result of your addiction.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that that is... goes back to some of our earlier points of people trying to escape a negative emotion.
Yes.
If we weren't afraid of dealing with negative emotions, we would have less addiction.
Exactly.
Because so much of that is about the escape.
That's true. And that leads to the whole thing is that you're not, the whole concept of once an addict, always an addict is just not the truth. Because
it's not. That's so self-defeating too. I hate that saying.
Totally. I hate it too. I'm so glad. And, you know, I've done a few interviews where you've spoken about this with various different doctors in the field. And I'm so happy to see that there's a shift away from this. For years it's been dominating that once an addict, always an addict, and you've got to learn to live with these things. You know, it's such a defeatist, it's such a biological framework, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's so like limiting for the person.
Yes.
What do you think about the whole sort of medicalizing misery and, you know, pathologizing suffering?
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Because in your book you appear to address... that to a certain extent.
You know, I think it's a little bit like the positive psychology movement where at one point we were trying to make everything biological because then it felt like a true science.
Yes.
It felt like it can be tangible and okay, we're going to align ourselves with the medical profession.
But have I think little 10 steps. And,
but them off. Right. But I think that it got turned on its head at some point because... at first, it really was helpful just so that the person doesn't keep blaming themselves. But then it became this issue of, well, then if it's biological, I can't do anything about it. And it takes away their confidence, their self-efficacy, their ability to see that it's changeable.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that simple, obviously. You know, nothing is that simple. You can't just identify it as a biological problem that can never be changed. And also biology can be changed. And that's what's most amazing about, you know, us human beings, is that there is so much that you can do at any point in life to build resilience and to change your path. And so, so my whole thing about the biomedical model is that it served a role, but people bought into it in a way that became harmful.
It kind of tipped on the other side, didn't it? Instead of bringing balance, it became all about that physical, reductionistic, classical kind of biomedical model. Everything's biological.
And I see the shift, like you were saying, talking to doctors. I'm sure you've noticed that a lot of physicians who were, you know, trained in traditional medical programs are now saying, but we see a role for holistic health. Like, see the role.
Yeah, well, they've been put under so much pressure to everyone. 90% of prescriptions are coming from doctors when it comes to mental health, but they have no training. I train physicians, and they don't have training in mental health.
They don't know what.
But they're seen as the mental health experts. You know, you've got to be a medical doctor.
Right.
Even more so than someone like yourself or myself, who have spent our entire career studying mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got to, that's that shift with the biomedical. And the doctors are under pressure. I mean, one physician a day commits suicide, and it's due to a multiplicity of factors. But we have to look at mental health differently, not as just this biological thing. Yeah. So when you talk about sabotaging thoughts, you've really brought that mind component in. You've really brought that, and you've brought the person back into the situation. Right. You're not telling the person you're sabotaging thoughts because you've got a broken brain.
No.
You're actually telling someone that, hey, these are thoughts that are, like, it's thoughts that are doing what they shouldn't be doing, and you can actually do something. You can use your thinking to change your thinking.
Right.
I was involved in some of the first neuroplasticity research back in the 80s with traumatic brain injuries and mind-brain changes and things. Uh-huh. And that's what I've spent my whole career researching, the mind-brain and how you're directed neuroplasticity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so when I read your work about sabotaging thoughts, it's very exciting because you are really showing people how to use the mind to actually change the structure of the brain.
Yes, that's exactly what we're trying to do. That's very empowering for
people. Yeah,
because again, people think about biology as totally unchangeable, and yet we've seen research, right?
Like genetics change.
Genetics change. You change over the course of your life. You know, when people have PTSD, for example, we find that sometimes their amygdalas are enlarged. You know, that actually it's devoting basically more of the brain to processing
whatever you think about the most will grow.
Yeah, and then of course, once people have gone through PTSD treatment, the amygdala shrinks back down to normal size. And so, yes, your thoughts and your patterns and how you behave and how you choose to live your life can actually change the actual biology, the actual structures of the brain.
Yeah.
I think that is powerful because people don't realize that. They think, once I've already had this biological injury or whatever they want to call
it.
It's done. Yeah. I'm done.
They've almost equated things like depression with things like cancer, and it feels uncontrollable. Yes. I've just finished a clinical trial now where there's many different aspects to it, but we were using QEEGs, and we saw that when you give people mind management, which is pretty much how to manage those thoughts that are sabotaging you over a period of time, over 9 weeks, we saw people that had the enlarged amygdalas, we had lower prefrontal cortex activity, we had hyperactivity in the wrong, the parts of the brain that you don't want too much high beta activity.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw just giving mind management skills, someone who was totally depressed, not sleeping, over a period of 9 weeks with mind management, the depression literally lifted and the sleeping, but it wasn't just some magic pill, it was the process of finding out the root cause. And you've expressed this so beautifully with your, the life values, the life process, your acronym, and then going through the process of defining your values and finding the cause. It's work. So my point of this statement is, it's a lot of work.
Yes.
Do you find people resist the amount of work involved in the mind?
Yeah, I think they do. And I think sometimes people are just always looking for that magic bullet.
Mm.
And I start my book by saying, sorry, if that's what you're looking for.
This is the wrong book.
Wrong book, you know. And actually, I don't think anybody can promise that to you. And if they did, they would be frauds. Because
but they have been.
It takes work.
Taking the tablet, taking the little 10 steps,
Yes, and you know, it's never that easy because there was time that it took for you to establish these bad behaviors or things that you want to change. So it's going to take time for you to shift. But the powerful thing is, if you take the time to do it, it will shift. Everybody is capable of change at any age.
Exactly. And that's beautiful. Say that again. That's so good.
Everybody is capable of change at any age. And we see that even in the brain, right? When people think, okay, well, my brain is aging. I've had a traumatic brain injury. It's not going to recover. And yet you even find, yes, of course, as you get older, your brain is a little less plastic, But there is still change.
But it's a different kind of plasticity, because there's a lot of, you can still, no matter what your age. I think my oldest patient was an 83-year-old who, 78-year-old, who wanted to become, couldn't fly anymore, he was a pilot and wanted to become an accountant. And he studied at 84, he qualified as an accountant.
Wow.
You know, and that was, so it's, I've had patients that have got holes, literally so much brain damage that they had been written off as vegetables getting university degrees. I mean, those are quite extreme.
Right.
But I know you've probably seen the same thing, people that feel completely hopeless and then going to a point where, what is the factor that you have seen that where you see those kind of changes, where people were came to you in a complete, maybe they were cutting themselves, maybe they were in a point where they were just like eating disorders and just the whatever, all those emotional and physical warning signals. And then there's this transformation and you start seeing the progress. Yeah.
What's the key
that you have seen in that transformation?
I think the key really is all in the mind, and that they finally made the shift of taking the limits off of their own mind.
Okay, you know? That's brilliant. Please say that again. People need to hear that.
They take the limits off of their own mind, because the mind is limitless.
Love it.
But you put that limit on yourself at some point, whether it's with the life factors or something else. You know, you're putting that limit on, I can't do this. My parents didn't get to do this. I'm too afraid of change. Mm. It's too late for me. I'm already in my 50s. I'm not going to change now. Those are limits that you put on your own mind.
And that's mind work. Those are mind limits. You're doing that with your mind.
Yeah. It's not your brain. It's your mind.
No, your brain just does what your mind tells it to do.
Yeah, exactly.
So I love the fact that you said that that's mind, because there's so many people that are going through tremendous physical pain. And it feeds back. Obviously, if you're in a lot of pain, it's going back into your mind. And those people very often will insist that this is not something that they have any control over.
Right.
And yes, you can have, you know, you can have an issue around, obviously, the physical that happens, but you still got your mind that you can use to help manage that process.
Exactly.
I don't know if you find any, if you've worked with anything like that in your practice.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that people sometimes forget that that's a feedback loop, you know, they neglect to think about it that way. And everything is interrelated. But that's also the beauty of it, you know,
exactly.
You can kind of choose one system to work on the other system.
Exactly.
And that's why it's so cool.
It's fantastic. Judy, is there anything else that you want to say about your, that we haven't covered in your book, or that you'd like to, anything else you'd like to say about your book specifically, and then we'll go to a wrap-up statement.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. You're brilliant. You're so much fun to talk to.
You and I could talk all night.
I feel like we could go on forever. Yeah. But thank you so much. It really is an honor to be here. And if anybody wants to check out more of this work, I actually do have a bunch of free resources on my website.
Wonderful.
So even without purchasing the book, they can do the live quiz. They can check into the values card game that I have. And my website is drjudyho.com.
That's amazing. And now the last question I have for you is, what keeps you up at night and what gets you going in the morning?
Oh, you know what keeps me up at night right now is just how isolated we all really are sometimes.
Oh, wow. Good
you
one.
Know, just being able to be here with you in person has been actually a really, really wonderful experience. I know that sometimes it's just the logistical limitations, but even podcasts are mostly done sometimes distally.
It's so nice to get to have
an actual conversation face to face.
I agree.
So I just encourage everybody, at least once a day, like, do an in real life interaction, right? We do so much on the computer, on our phones, and like, make the time to connect with people at least one time a day where it feels like it's a face to face, because we're losing that. And I think that that actually is contributing sometimes to the downfall of our society. Yeah, it does. It contributes to the downfall of our mental health too. You
can't live in isolation. That's absolutely wonderful. I love that. And what gets you up in the morning? What makes you excited for the day?
Well, I love my job. I love the things that I do. So what gets me up in the morning is just like what the day could bring. You know, every single day is so different in my schedule. And I feel very fortunate and blessed to have the kind of work life that I do.
But you've made a choice with your mind to be like that, haven't you?
I did. That's true. See, it's a choice that you make.
You've made a choice.
You can always choose to think about all the terrible things that are happening every
day,
all the hardships, or you can wake up and think about each day as an opportunity.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you one last question. I know that was the last one, but this one I think is a relevant one. You are dealing with a lot of pain in people's lives. So you're constantly on a day-to-day basis hearing very sad stories and seeing people that are broken. How do you protect your mental health?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm an avid runner, and it really does help me to stay physically active, because I'm not going to miss out on those free endorphins, you know?
Exactly.
Those are good free antidepressants that I'll have every day if I keep doing all of my exercises. But also, I make time to just do things that really make me unplug. Like, I have these shows that I watch. I mean, sometimes after I had a very hard day, I can't watch very scary
things. I get it.
Yeah. Can't watch Ozark. Can't watch like Game of Thrones. No. But like I will,
something as simple as
I want to watch like Friends or like Cupcake Wars.
Yes.
Like I want to live. I want to live in a world where the worst thing that could happen is they don't make the 1,000 cupcakes. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Like, I love that.
It's great. Yeah. So I need to sometimes just unplug and watch cartoons. I recently just got Disney Plus, so I started watching all of my old like favorite Disney movies again, like Little Mermaid and like The Lion King.
I love that. It's so calming, isn't it?
It is.
We went to go and see Frozen recently, and I just love. I mean, I just Frozen. The best.
Did you see the musical?
Or no, we saw the movie, but it's so nice to unplug. That's incredible. Yeah. Well, Judy, you've been amazing. It's been so exciting to meet with you in person and get to know you. Your work is fantastic, and I would certainly love to have you back on the podcast again.
Thank
and very, very excited about what you're doing, and keep going with the great work that you are doing.
Thank you so much for coming today. I appreciate it, and hopefully we'll get to keep in touch.
Yes, please, let's do, and I'd love to have you back on the podcast. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Caroline.
I hope you found today's podcast interesting and helpful. If you want more tips and help with managing anxiety, depression, and mental health, be sure to visit my website at drleaf.com and to sign up for my weekly newsletter, where I also include a schedule of my speaking events and so much more. And follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Just look for Dr. Caroline Leaf. Also, I love seeing all your posts on social media about this podcast. I love seeing what resonates with you and what you've learned. So be sure to continue posting and tagging me and letting me know what you think and how these tips worked out for you. And don't forget, leave a review and keep spreading the word about this podcast. Thank you for joining me today. I really hope you learned something new and helpful. Till then, I'm Dr. Caroline Leaf.